Okay, we'll pick up on we'll pick up where we were, which is 1 Kings, Lachmalis. Ooh, careful here. Chapter 12, I believe.
Yeah.
Verse.
Oh, this was where you were going to compare with Divrei HaYamim.
Yeah, we did that actually a little bit last week. We broached a philosophical issue on whether people have free choice or not, but it hasn't been solved in the last 5,000 years, so I'm not going to solve it. I just wanted to really raise the issue because I think it's an important one.
Can we fault the 15 Solomon for raising his children properly?
The prophet does. Are you asking me a factual question, or whether we as religious Jews are in a position to fault King Shlomo?
You would think that these basic things that they would teach their children.
I don't think they were. The question was, is ecumenicalism a good thing? I think a lot of people feel it is a good thing. So it's hard to say. You know, I made an emphasis there that Shlomo was never over the Avodah Zarah. He just let his wives do it.
Yeah, no,
so the question is, I wouldn't think that they were over the Avodah Zarah. They're not accused of such a sin. And when there are kings that do worship Avodah Zarah, and there are kings that worship Avodah Zarah, they will be pointed out that they are. So I believe that in the silence of the prophet against Rehoboam, Rehoboam had a lot of problems. Rehoboam and Shlomo had a lot of problems. I don't believe that was one of them. But we'll see when we read about his history. Right now we're more going to be focused on Yeravam, because again, as I emphasized, this book is a book written by northern prophets. From this point on, from Yeravam's point on, and it would be a good comparison if you want to do on your own to compare what's going on here from this point of the story after the rebellion begins to what's going on in Divrei HaYamim. Divrei HaYamim doesn't talk about the northern kings at all. It doesn't care about Yeravam. Never mentions the word Beit El. It's just not, the Egel HaZahav doesn't even come up except in passing. You know, it's a slight, you know, you barely see it. It goes by so fast. But this is written by the northern kings, by the northern prophets. The center of this book was written by the northern prophets, who Achia HaShiloni, of course, is the prophet who's probably writing this narrative. Achia HaShiloni was a guy from Shiloh, he's from Shevet Ephraim, who was advising Yeravam to rebel. And it's Achia's group that will continue writing the prophecy here, and that's why the focus is very much on the northern kings. Yeravam the first, Yeravam the second, Achav, of course, gets Eliyahu, Yehu gets Elisha. It's this book. Right now we've entered what I would call a separate section of Sefer Melachim, which is really the focus is on the north and what caused the destruction of the north. And that's what we're going to focus on today. Hopefully we'll get to it, which is the question of the Egel HaZahav, because that's going to be the big numero uno sin, so we're going to have to analyze exactly what is the sin of Egel HaZahav. We have discussed it a little bit in these forums before, but it's something I think which requires re-emphasis. Anyway, let's continue on with the text. I think Pasuk Yud Zion. Oh, that's on Perek Yud Bet. I think we'll start off where he told him bad news. He's not going to listen to a word he says, and he's going to throw scorpions at him or whatever it is. And then verse 15 says that he wouldn't listen to them in order to fulfill the prophets. That was verse 15, so now we're at verse 16. Ted Zion. Vayar kol Yisrael ki lo shama ha-melech aleihem. So when they saw that the king wasn't listening to them, and here again I want to emphasize that according to the basic text it looks like they would have if they could have. And that's always a big question. Was it all a big setup and they didn't want to pay attention to him anyway? Or they would have, had he been a good king, they would have been happy to go along with him. Again, based on these psukim, I think that it's clear that they would have if they would have if they could have.
Was a good king? Low taxes?
So, yeah, well, isn't the same, has anything changed over the last 3,000 years? Everybody promises to lower taxes. This is the only politician that promised to up taxes. Look what happened. They all rebelled against them. So there you go. Remember the elder Bush when he got caught for saying raising taxes, when he said, read my lips, I won't raise taxes? That was the end of his, that was the only 4 years he'd be spending in the government. So things haven't changed. Actually, this is, I'm sort of being funny about it. This is much worse. These are people taxes. This isn't, you're talking about corvée work. You're not talking about money. Halavai. You're talking about having to spend X amount of months in the fields or in the mountains of Lebanon cutting stones and building. And of course, kings back then, and maybe kings and presidents today, make their name on what they build. The wars that they make, but even more so, a peacetime king makes his name on what he builds. Herod, I mean, I can name Ashurbanipal, who created the vast library in Ashur and Nineveh. I could name to you all the greatest peacetime kings were always great builders, because that's where they actually put their names on the buildings, of course. So we have from Nebuchadnezzar, from Nebuchadnezzar the second, so you have entire, you know, stones where every ninth stone was encrypted with his name. So that's too bad for him in these days, because now if you have one of those stones, it's not worth as much money as you would like it to be, because it's not quite as believe it or not, it's not quite as rare. You could really, it's not so hard to come by a Nebuchadnezzar stone if you know what you're looking for. So in any event, so that's it, essentially. They were asking to reduce taxes, but taxes not in the sense, you know, am I going to pay 33% or 30% of my check, but really whether I'm going to have to send my son to slavery for at least a period of time, or they were. Now, and here they say something that's really resounding. It's something very important. So they respond to him as follows. Malanu chelik b'David, velo nachala b'ven Yishai. Malanu doesn't mean what is our portion with David. And malanu means we have no portion with David, and we have no inheritance with Ben Yishai, with the son of Yishai. Le'o halecha Yisrael. Everybody go to their own tents. So essentially, these words are very evocative. They're not only evocative because they're used here, but because these words have been heard before. Where have they been heard before? When David comes back from a successful conquest of his rebellious son, Absalom, his son, rebelled. David runs away to the other side of the Jordan River. He comes back. Absalom is killed by Yoav. There are a whole bunch of stories there which we're not going to get into. But he's faced with an immediate rebellion. The rebellion was from the tribe of Benjamin, which is significant, because Benjamin here is the only one that sticks to Shevet Yehuda. And there's a guy named Sheva ben Bichri. So if you're curious to look at it, it is in Shmuel Bet, that's 2 Samuel, chapter 20. So I'll read it to you. If you don't have it, that's fine. I'll read it to you and translate. Visham nekra ish Belial. There was a man. Belial is a hard to say what that word is. A man without worth, perhaps. Ushmo Sheva ben Bichri. His name was Sheva ben Bichri. Ishimini. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. Vayikab shofar. He blew a shofar. Vayomar ein lanu chelik b'David velo nachala lanu b'ven Yishai ish lo alav Yisrael. It's a direct quote. Which means, essentially, that the new group is re-quoting the old group, but they're not just breaking apart, because they understand that it's not just a question of breaking apart from Shlomo's son, they're breaking apart from the entire Davidic dynasty. That's a much more powerful statement that they're making, and they are attempting to evoke, I believe, what has already been said before. So in a way, this is a continuation of the same... They're intentionally recalling history in order to recreate history. And I'll tell you why there's actually a sort of a secondary proof for that. I'll tell you something very interesting. When David first takes charge of his country, and there's really no issue of civil war, so it goes through a list of all of his, chapter 7 in Samuel Bet, I won't read it now. It goes through a list of all of his officers. The list of officers did not include a guy by the name of Adoniram, who's on the Mas. He's not there. Here, after the rebellion is put down to Sheva ben Bichri, we have, again, the list of the exact same officers plus one new guy, which is Adoniram HaHamas. And why is that indicative? Because, you don't really know the truth is. You won't really find out until you learn Sefer Malachim. That's just a new guy. He got a job. Does that mean there wasn't a tax collector before? So again, if you think of taxes the way tax collectors are now, of course there was a tax collector. You have a government. You need a tax collector. But Adoniram's job was not simply tax collector. He was sheriff of Nottingham. Do you see what I'm getting at? He wasn't the guy who looked around and said, "Can I please have 10% of your, you know, taxes?" Or even, "Please, I'll have 10% of your taxes or I'll throw you in jail." He was the guy who took people away. That's what his job was. His job was to suppress the people financially and with corvée work, because that was the best way of suppressing your people. How do we know that that's true? Because here, what's going to happen is, guess who shows up on the scene during this rebellion? Let's take a look. Back in 1 Kings, chapter 12, verse 17. So verse 17 says, "Uvnei Yisrael yoshvim b'arei Yehudah, v'yimloch aleihem rechavam." So Bnei Yisrael ha-yoshvim b'arei Yehudah, all of the Israelites who were in the Judean towns, Vayimloch aleihem Rechavam. That's very interesting, by the way, which I'm not going to get into right now. But that seems to indicate that there were other non-Judeans living in Judean towns that essentially went along with Yehuda. So it wasn't exactly split along Shevet lines. It was more or less split along territorial lines. It happens to be the territorial lines were close to Shevet lines. But it's very interesting. According to some of Farshim, only the Yehudaites, sorry, only the Benjamites who were living in Yehuda's territory, only they went along with Yehuda. That's not what the pasuk says, but that's the impression, and the proof that's brought up is because Beit El turns out to be a city that A, belongs to Binyamin, and it becomes the capital of, not the capital, but it becomes the cultic city, the religious city of the north. How is that possible if it's a Benjamite city? Answer is, some Benjamins obviously didn't go along with the whole deal. So that sort of, this pasuk sort of gives that indication. If you just hold the question for a second, I just want to read the next pasuk. Vayishvach HaMelech Yerchavam, after he becomes the king, so he sends Adoram, that's Adoniram, there's like that, that's our sheriff of Nottingham. Asher al Amas, Vayir Gemu call Yisrael Bo Evan Vayamot, and they'll stone him and he dies. You see? They don't like Adoniram. But now they're in the position to off the sheriff of Nottingham, and that's exactly what they do. Now, by the way, verse 18 is before verse 17, because in verse 17 he goes back to Yushalayim to be kinged, to be enthroned. But we go back in time to the point that Rechavam is still in Shechem with Adoniram. So those people will say, listen, we got nothing to do with you. So what does he do? He sends Adoniram. He says, you suppress the people. The people having none of it. So they kill him. And what happens? V'amelech Rechavam hitameit v'alop b'mer chavad. The Melech Rechavam, he almost didn't get up back onto his chariot. He had to fight his way back onto his chariot. Lanus Yerushalayim, in order to run back to Yerushalayim. So it was a close call for Rechavam. And the powerful statement that the North makes is that they murder the tax collector that they remember very well as being the, sort of a symbol of the suppression of the previous rebellion. So it's both a realistic gesture as well as a symbolic one. I'm sorry, you wanted to...
Don't we see when Joshua divided up the land that the tribe of Shimon was given land inside the area of the tribe of Judah?
Yeah, they moved north. I think that's a supposition. I think it's in I don't remember. It's in one of the Nevi'im. I remember reading an article about it, but it was a long time ago, and somebody had proven that Shevet Shimon had ran away to the north and divided itself from Yehuda sometime, I don't know, maybe during David's period of time, or maybe not. So B'li Neder, I'll see if I can scrounge up the article. It's a long time that I saw that. And now I just give it as an axiom. Shevet Shimon must have moved north. What's the proof? The proof is, because 10 plus 2 equals 12, or 12 minus 2 equals 10, so therefore Shimon has to be in the north. Ah, they were living in the south, so I guess they moved north, but I believe there is actually a textual proof, but I off the top of my head, I don't remember it. So believe that, or I'll try to find it.
Isn't this unusual that it seems to be like they're legalists here? The people, you know, rebel,
yeah,
and they kill the tax collector,
yeah,
and like, who's behind this? They all speak one mind?
No, when you say Ish Yisrael, you're talking about you're not talking about the Hoi Poloi, you're talking about elected governors, you're talking about a senator, a congress, if you will.
Oh, you mean
and they'll become very, very important. We haven't really seen them up to this point, because Shlomo really kept things close to his, he kept all his cards close to his chest. You didn't see that kind of democracy. We spoke about it a little bit last week, the idea between a limited monarchy and an unlimited monarchy, and how David, according to the Malbim, had a more of a limited monarchy. But we'll see there are people called Ish Yisrael and Ish Yehuda that call the shots. The king is not as free as one would think. So we'll see. Not only that, in fact, you're getting to a point that I want to make. Yerovam, in my opinion, is a wishy-wash, and I'll prove it in a second. So it's really, he's a puppet, in a sense, to what the Ish Yisrael wants to do, in a sense. But let's see if I could show that from the verses.
So
where does it say here Ish Yisrael? In verse 16, it says, here it says, Vayar kol Yisrael kilo shama hamelech aleihem, vayeshivu avet hamelech davar lemor malanu chelek, etc., etc. I'll tell you where it is. Hold on a second. Yeah, here it says, in verse 20 it says, call Yisrael. In verse... Yeah, you're right. You're right. Here it seems to be a
Israel, it's like everybody.
Yeah, it does seem to be a popular uprising. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I was mistaken. I don't see the word Ish Israel here, although it does come up now and then. Here it is not. And I think you have to say that this is a popular uprising. Yeah?
Yeah.
But in Pasuk 20, first of all, above, we had what Yerovam was...
Was throned.
He was in Shem, was speaking with, he was a leader.
Yeah, and now
and
he's
now
gone.
They have to call for him.
Yeah, it's a little strange. Let me get to that. Let me read that now. It's a very difficult pasuk. Vayhi kishmo kol Yisrael kishav Yerovam. And when all of the people heard that Yerovam had returned, went back where? Where was he? That is, what's going on? The rebellion's already on. They killed the tax collector. Yerovam was there when he heard the no from Rechavam. How do we know that? Because it says, take a look in Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayavo Yerovam v'chol ha'am el Rechavam. By Yom HaShlishi, Kasher Diber HaMelech, which means he was right involved in that whole tete-a-tete that went south, that went bad. So Yerovam was certainly in Shechem, but all of a sudden in verse 20, he's not in Shechem. Vayhi Shmo Kol Yisrael Kishav Yerovam. So where did he go? And where's he coming back from? It's a little strange. So the Radak answers it, I think, in a not entirely satisfying way. He says he went home. He went home to family, he didn't know he was going to be enthroned. He thought he was maybe just, according to Radak, maybe he was just like a politician involved, but he didn't really believe that he was going to be enthroned. The question is, didn't he hear the prophecy? So there's a few possibilities. One is that Yerovam's a wishy-washy guy, which is something I was really trying to point out from the first two verses. Because take a look in 12, 1 and 2. So this is also very strange. Look, Vayelech Rechavim Shechem. So Rechavim goes Shechem. Yishchem ba'kol Yisrael malich oto. Vayehi kishmo Yerovam ben Nevat v'hu odenu Mitzrayim. That is, all of the north got together in Shechem to force Rechavim's hand, Rechavim the son of Shlomo's hand. But Yerovam's not there. Yerovam is still in Mitzrayim. Apparently, he's not ready to come out of hiding. Because remember, he was public enemy number one. Asher barach mepnei hamelech Shlomo. Vayeshev Yerovam b'Mitzrayim. He settled in Mitzrayim. Vayeshlechu vayikru lo. Now look at those words. Compare the words in verse 3 to the words in verse 20. Vayeshlechu vayikru lo. They sent a messenger and they called him. Vayavo Yerovam b'chol kal Yisrael. Take a look at verse 20. Vayehi kishmo kol Yisrael kishav Yerovam vayishlechu vayikru'u oto el ha'idat. You see, it's essentially the exact same thing. You follow? Which means it's possible that verse 20 is a flashback tied together with the words vayishlechu vayikru'u lo. Those are called resumptive verbs. Which means, when was he throned? He was throned in verse 3. Which is, they called him right away, the narrative took a short stop while we discussed how it was everything went south, and now we're resuming what actually happened at the time, which is that they enthroned him. Same story, but different perspective. The only problem is, if you say that, then my whole theory about how they were willing to give Rechavim a chance goes down the toilet. Why? Because that, if you read that verse 20 is happening at the same time as verse 3, that means right away they called him and they throned him right at the time. You follow? Mm-hmm. So, that is, if you take verse 20 and you say that it's really a resumption of the narrative that started in verse 3, then at the same time that they called Rechavam to show up and gave him this whole bogus ultimatum, they had actually already sort of secretly enthroned Yerovam. That's the way the Pesukim look now, even though everything I've taught up to that point doesn't look like that. But what I said, Radak says it's all big setup. Obviously Radak maybe knows what he's talking about. But the other possibility is Yerovam is a wishwash. He goes, he comes. Maybe when Adoni Rav HaLamas shows up, he's like, I'm out of here. I can't take on Adoni Rav HaLamas. That's my old boss's sheriff of Nottingham. I'm going home. I'm out of here. I'm going back to Mitzrayim. They kill the sheriff of Nottingham. They kill Adoni Rav HaLamas. And now they got to call Yerovam again, who's disappeared with the fight. That's the only other way I think to Radak simplifies it. Yerovam was a brave guy. He was always with them. He was in charge. He went home for a little. He went home for some tea, and then they needed him back, so they enthroned him. But that's not. I don't think that really goes with the text. Possibility number two is that this is a resumptive narrative that they enthroned him already back in verse 3 from the words Vayikru Vayavov Elayida. And then you have a problem with my theory that they were willing to give the southern kings a chance. So I'm not crazy about that because it doesn't agree with my theory. It's not a great reason not to be crazy about it, but I'm not crazy about it. And the third possibility is Yerubbaal is an unbelievably wishy-washy character. An unbelievably wishy-washy character. Every time when the heat starts, he gets out of the kitchen. What? He gets going. Yerubbaal gets going. So that's another possibility. He's really, and I think maybe that's an emphasis. A little, it could be a little jab if we read these psukim sequentially. A little jab, a little bit. Yerubbaal, this is the kind of guy that you've gotten, and this will, might tell you why this everything happened. The only question is that doesn't entirely agree with the Yerubbaal that we're going to meet, because the Yerubbaal that we're going to meet, well, we'll see. We'll see. I'll let you draw your own conclusions on whether Yerubbaal was a wishwash. Yeah.
Okay. A couple of things. It seems to me that they could have a group. Could have called him, not all of Israel.
Yeah, I think call Israel of him.
And he comes back, and he's a representative. By his presence there, he's already a threat.
Right.
So it strengthens their hand with Rehoboam. He says, you know, Rehoboam looks and says, look, they've already got another leader, maybe I should pay attention.
Right.
And then they said, forget it, it all blew up.
Right.
And they went back because it wasn't all of Israel that called him. And the sheriff of Nottingham comes and he starts in one place. And then that's where he ends. So then they say,
Who? Adoni Ramanas?
Yeah, he goes to one town or he goes to Shechem.
Well, Shechem is the capital.
Well, not yet.
Not yet, but soon.
Right. Yeah, right. But, you know, so, and the popular uprising does away with him.
Right.
So then they say, you know what, we really need to have, we're through with them, we want to incorporate our own nation. And so we need to choose a king, let's get Yerubbaal.
But where did Yerubbaal go? That is, where did Yerubbaal disappear?
He went back to his family.
At what point? Before Adoniram attacks? He was there during the negotiations with Rehoboam that went south. He's clearly not there after, assuming that we're reading these psukim sequentially in time, not chronologically. He's
not.
What's that?
It might not be chronological.
Yeah, I know. I'm aware of that. But if it's not chronological, so you've got all kinds of other problems. I'm playing chronologically because unless I can really prove that it's not chronological, I prefer, you know, it's a Ramban's point standpoint. You could say ein muktam muchar b'Torah, that there's no chronology in the Torah, but you have to have a really good proof to do so. I'm not sure that my resumptive verbs are enough of a proof to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it does seem to disagree. The idea that they enthroned him right away does really seem to disagree with everything that was being said in negotiation wise. I don't know exactly what to make. I don't know what to make of the story. Why did he disappear? Where did he go to? And they make a point. Vayihi kishmor kol Yisrael kishav Yerubbaal. When they heard that he had returned. Returned where? Now, you can't say he went to the bathroom or something and he returned to Shechem, because then the next sentence, which is the next verse, which said they called him, wouldn't make any sense. He's clearly returning away from Shechem to place X. Why not tell us where he's going? It's a difficult verse any way you look at it. Did he run away to Mitzrayim when Adoniram? And by, you know, keep in mind, things don't happen. When you read Pesukim, it looks like everything happens 5 seconds after the previous pasuk. That's an error. It's an error to think that. You know, there may have been 3 weeks of tough negotiations, and then Adoniram brings his forces, and the people all hide, and then they come out of hiding, and then they were all going to fight. You know, just because verse 18, we read it a second after verse 17, doesn't mean it happened a second after verse 17. That's a common mistake that people make when they're reading Tanakh. There's a lot of stuff. Tanakh's not a history book in the chronological sense. The goal is not to teach you history. What happens A happens after B. It's to teach you religious history. Sometimes facts are deleted, and sometimes things are rolled all together in one big heading. So the question is, there may have been a lot of messy stuff going on, but where did he return to? I find verse 20 difficult, unless you just say that he ran away.
Called him up initially,
right,
to have him be potentially the leader, and he was there then during the course of the negotiations. The negotiations fell apart, and the popular uprising came. They killed Adoniram when Rehoboam tried to reestablish himself.
Right.
Okay. They killed him. Rehoboam left. At that point, Yerubbaal. Yeah. Said, okay, well, the king is gone, and things will quiet down.
Right.
And the people said, hey, time out. Things aren't quieting down. We want you back here as king.
Agreed. I agree.
Maybe
he was
raising
a reasonable storyline. I think that is a reasonable storyline, and I think it emphasizes And along with, you know, even in the first two verses, he was back, he was forth. There's a sense that, I think that what you're saying, which is the way I read it, is that if you don't want to call him a wuss, he's the guy who just doesn't feel the calling. Either he doesn't think it, that is, why doesn't he think, he's heard the prophecy, Achiyashi, when he dragged him aside and said, you're going to be the king. Even if he didn't believe him at the time, he's got to believe him now, and yet he's still walking. So, either you could say he's a puppet of the people, I understand, but I think that the narrative is made in such a way to stress that, the question is, why does the Navi need us to know that this is Yerubim's character, he's a balker? And that's exactly the point I guess I've been spending the last 10 minutes over trying to make, when you really put it together in one sentence. What?
Moshe Rabbeinu was a balker too.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure I want to compare Yerubim to Moshe Rabbeinu, but...
I'm saying he was not the first person to have a calling.
In Achinami.
To call the front lines.
So you know what? Now I'm gonna lay my cards down, just because I always like to... You're right about Shlomo, and I'll try to show you where I'm going with Yerubim in a second. I think the Pesukim will bear it out. Shlomo, Moshe Rabbeinu, our tendency is to think that he was an overly loyal, anav, you know, commotion, so, you know, to a fault, even to a fault, which is fair to say. He was really so, and you meet people like that, they're so humble. You know, kids just, doesn't mean that you're egotistical to say, yeah, I'm good at something. That doesn't make somebody an egotist. You could be humble to a fault, and that may have been an issue with Moshe Rabbeinu. That's certainly the impression in Sefer Shmuel. I think Yerubim's got something else going on, which is paranoia. I think Yerubim has another reason why he doesn't want to be the king, because he's afraid that the minute he takes the king, everybody is going to try to kill him, or he's going to do bad, or there's something else going on in Yerubim's psyche. And I'm sort of, I put that forward just because you drew a parallel between Moshe Rabbeinu and Yerubim, and it's true, they both act in the same way, but I wanted to show that there may be a different reason why they're acting the same way. But I think maybe I'm going to read on and let the verses talk for themselves. Let's see what he actually does, and we'll try to make an impression. No, I don't think that's exactly.
He may not be a strong leader, but he's a strong person.
Why do you say that?
Which midrash are you thinking of?
The one where Hashem and he and David HaMelech are walking together, and
Shlomo.
Not Shlomo. David and Hashem and Yerubim.
And
Yerubim says, "Who gets to walk first?"
Oh, I do know this midrash, and he says David goes first because he was able to fight against his hater. What was it exactly?
I don't even know if it says because.
Yeah. You know.
And Yerubim says, "Huh? I go first or nothing."
But the Medrash.
Right, but the Medrash, the Medrash.
Yeah, but the Medrash is an analysis of the same verses that we're reading, and Chazal.
Makes him sound like
he's the question is, but the Medrash wouldn't make that up from nowhere. The Medrash would be deriving that from the text somehow. So what did the Medrash see in Yerubim that I can't really speak to, because I remember learning the Medrash, but it's been a while, and you have to closely analyze that to see what the point is. So I'll just leave it on the table for now. But you're right, this may not be the only opinion. This was just trying to make, what Chazal make out of Tanakh is clearly better than anything that I can make out of Tanakh. Anyway, let's, what's that?
Chaval?
Yeah, Chaval. No, we're up to, Chaval. Vayavo Yerubim Yerushalayim Vakel Kol Beit Yisrael Vayachev Binyamin Meu Shmoni Melech Bachur Osei Milchama. He gets together a force of 180,000 chosen ones. Vayilachem in Beit Yisrael Lashivet Amuchah LeRechavim Ben Shlomo, which means it's time for civil war. He pulls together an army, 180,000 Bachur. Why is that word Bachur is very significant, by the way. I don't want to go into it now, but the Benjamites were always known as from a city called Bachur, and they were called the Bachurim. They were the same ones that used to hit a target from X and they wouldn't miss. They're the ones that took on, in the end of Shoftim, they take on all of Israel and win consecutively, essentially. They're sharpshooters. Ehud Ben-Gera was probably their leader. He was an assassin. These are the Binyamins were the toughest soldiers. They were like your shock troops of Israel. So Rechavim has significantly put together a force which can win back the south. He's ready to go to war. Now something very strange happens here. Vayhi Dvar Elohim El Shemaya Ish Elohim Lemor. Now I hope you enjoy Shemaya, because this is the first and the last you'll be seeing of him. We don't know what happens, so he doesn't disappear, he doesn't die as far as we know, but this is his only prophecy that we're aware of, which, by the way, and I always take these asides, don't assume that the prophets that wrote books are the only prophets around. It's false. It's a mistake to assume that. There were the famous Chazal, there were thousands of prophets. The ones that were recorded, the ones whose prophecies were needed forever rather than needed once upon a time. That is, their prophecies were eternally correct. When Yeshayahu tells you, well, I hate to say it, when he tells you that if you build big buildings and you live in gigantic houses and the poor have no place to live, you're all going to suffer, that's an eternal prophecy that's needed all the time, especially with the whole McMansion thing going on. So all you have to do is read Yeshayahu and you get the point of that. Shemaya was a prophet, every bit as much as we don't know whether he was a greater prophet than Ahiah or less prophet than Ahiah, but the bottom line is whatever he said only had to do with this one-time deal. Let's read what he says. Emor Rechavam ben Shlomo Melech Yudah. Go to Rechavam, the son of Shlomo Melech Yudah, the Kol Beit Yudah, Uvinyamin, and talk to old Benjamin Yudah, the Yeter Amli Mor, and the rest of the people. Kol Mar Hashem, Lo Ta'alu, Velo Tirachamu, Nachachem, Bnei Yisrael, Shubu Yis Lebeito, Kimei Tiyaniya, Dvar Zeh, Yishmu Dvar Hashem, Veyashubu Recha Kidvar Hashem. So the prophet says, stop the civil war now, and they stop. It's interesting because it paints a little picture of a character of Rechavam. Although I think it's very indicative that it says Vayishmeu et Dvar Hashem. It doesn't say Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, the son of David, listens to him. They all listen to him. So again, you got this kind of thing where he's not quite as powerful as he seems, and there's a whole clutch of people that are deciding that the prophet is right and the civil war is a bad idea. Nonetheless, Rechavam here, and there's a reason why it says Rechavam ben Shlomo ben David, because he's trying to tell you that just even though, because I think, what's that?
Who he is. Yep.
In what you mean, just as far as the pedigree goes?
Yeah.
I think there may be a religious statement, perhaps, or perhaps I'm reading more into it, which is, you know, we've just painted Rechavam in the worst possible light. We've painted him black, black, black. But keep in mind that he's a grandson of David HaMelech, and a prophet came up to him and said, don't make civil war. And he didn't make civil war. You know, whether it was just because of him, whether because the people didn't want to, but the bottom line is, he's not, you know, it's shades of gray here. And I think that's an important statement that's supposed to be made. So the civil war... What's that?
Who is Yeter Ha'am?
Where are you? Well, I'm sorry, what verse?
The end of
Kapitel. Oh, that's why, it's a good question. I believe that was referring back to verse 17 where it says that all of the children of Israel who were living in the cities of Yehuda went along with the Judean tribe.
Okay.
So I think what it's trying to say is it's not just quite black and white that everybody always thinks that if you're not a Kohen if you're not a Kohen or Levi, you're Israel. What does that mean? That you're from Shevet Yehuda. It's not so simple, actually. Probably you're from Shevet Yehuda, a good 9 out of 10, or even 95 out of 100 Shevet Yehuda, but there's at least a decent chance that you're not. You could easily be from one of these other tribes. Both here and a later time, there was also an assimilation between the tribes as well. So I think that's what it's referring to.
Yeah, here is a comment on that. It says,
go ahead.
Those residents of Jerusalem who were from other tribes and some members of Simeon who...
Yeah. Yeah. So there's
enclave in the territory of Judah.
Yeah, but did you notice it said some members of Shimon? Because it can't say all members of Shimon, because then 12 minus 2 equals 9, right? Not 12 minus 2 equals 10. You're missing tribe of Shimon. So they justified that some people of Shimon. I have two problems. Is that Artscroll? Good, because I feel comfortable beating up on Artscroll. So the two errors is I think it's trying to wimp out on the whole Shimon issue, and also it says I don't know why it says just Yerushalayim. It's interesting it says just Yerushalayim, because it must be getting, I mean, it's not bad, but it's taking it from verse 17. I don't know why it's Yerushalayim. It could be Be'er Sheva, it could be Chevron, it could be...
Maybe because it uses the word Alu. It says those residents of Yerushalayim who are from other tribes and some members of Shimon.
Yeah, I don't know why it limited to Yerushalayim, though. I don't see the reason for it, although it's... You know,
who
live
in scattered enclaves within the territory of Judah.
Lo Talu, why? No, because if they're in Yerushalayim, it would be Lo Toridu, if anything, so you can't really go there. No, I think it's just a mistake in the art scroll. I think they meant well, but they got it wrong. Okay, pretty much. It's a good description of it. I shouldn't do that. It's not always bad. Yeah, so they
met. You have to go from all the other Shabbatim coming down.
Correct, but I wouldn't, you know, just like today, people mix and mingle, and that's not what the Pasuk says. The Pasuk says, Vnei Yisrael Yashrim Ba'are Yehuda. You know, that's plural. I don't know, the article probably, it's probably a small mistake. They probably really meant Yerushalayim and everywhere else. They probably just chose the capital because people do that. Anyway, let's continue on. It gets interesting. Oh, so based now, is there a civil war or is there not a civil war? Now, again, don't look at this in a small way. He gathered together 180,000 people in one pusik. You follow what I'm saying? That didn't happen in one pusik. That didn't happen as fast as I read it. There's a call-up. There are threats. I'll tell you what I'm going to do to your side. I'm going to tell you on your side. There are messengers. Somebody gets his hair shaved. There's all kinds of things going on that the pusik don't tell us. But you don't call up 180,000 people. You don't even in modern times, you don't call up 180,000 people in a pusik. So you surely don't call it back up then. But so there's a whole thing going on here. You know, it's not like a light switch where you turn it on, 100,000 people, everybody go home. Why am I saying that? Because based on Pasuk Chaf Dalet, based on Pasuk Chaf Aleph, there is no more war. War's over. Right? We started the war, everybody goes home. The only problem is, take a look at the next Pasuk. I'm sorry, that was Chaf Dalet. Chaf Hey. Vayiven Yeravam Et Shechem. And by the way, be careful with the word Vayiven. One might assume that Vayiven means to build, but Shechem is obviously already built. So what is it? What is it? What does it really mean?
Built up.
Built up. You know,
fortified.
Fortified. Exactly right. Now, why do you have to fortify it if there's no war?
Well,
I understand, but the prophet, this Shemaiah comes over, he goes, I want all the people of you to go home. Yeravam wakes up and all the soldiers go by and there's a little note that says, prophet told us to go home. So if that's it, you know, if it's just black and white, so knock down your walls. Everybody's happy. So,
what's
that?
He figured out that he was afraid, so he built.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So maybe there really was no war, in which case it's an indication of, again, the kind of paranoia that was going on with Yeravam. Yeravam, he's not listening to the prophet so much, really, is he? Prophet told him to be king. He's not sure he wanted it to be. Prophet told him there's not going to be a war. He said there isn't, but maybe there is a little bit of war, and I'll show you why. Look at this strange pusset.
Maybe he's not so sure that it's going to stay that way.
Yeah, it's true. It's not necessarily the worst move in the world, but here's a weird pusset. Look at in 25. Let's finish 25. Vayiven Yeravam et Shechem Bahar Ephraim Vayeshev Bahin. He rules in it. He settles in it. Vayetze Misham. He leaves there. Vayiven et Pnuel. Why? Where did he go? He got bored? It was like a summer house? He abandons his capital city and he goes to Pnuel.
Spreading his kingdom.
That's one way to look at it. That's true. Do you know where Pnuel is, by the way?
No.
East of Jordan. It is east of the Jordan River. That's where, by the way, Pnuel, Panim, that's where Yaakov fought with the angel, and he saw Hashem, and that was the city that, what happened? Gidon. Remember Gidon is fighting the enemies, and they're chasing, and he goes over to these two cities. One's called Sukkot, which is another place that Yaakov stopped by, and another one is called Pnuel. And he says, I need some food. And the guys say to him, what, you won the war already? We're going to give you food? We got problems out here. And he says, when I win this war, Gidon says, I'm going to come back and I'm going to knock down your wall, and I'm going to take these thorns and I'm going to scatter them all over your body. I'm going to, essentially, he wiped out the town. It was not it was across the Jordan River town. I'll show you exactly where it is. Here, I got a map. Here's the Jordan, let me stand up so people can hear it. Here's the Jordan River. Shechem is around here. Here's Shechem. Pnuel is over here on the Yabok River, because remember Yaakov crossed the Yabok River and then he crossed backwards in the Yabok River. It's not clear to me if it's in Reuben's territory or God's territory, but one of the two territories. But it's across the Jordan River. Why would a king cross over the Jordan River? Now, you could say he's trying to extend the monarchy. I hadn't thought about it before you said that, and I think that's a viable answer. However, we've seen one other king cross the Jordan River. After Saul's death, a guy named Mephibosheth, I'm sorry, Ish-bosheth took
David
over.
David did also.
Running
from Absalom.
Exactly right. David ran away from Absalom, ready to go across the Jordan River. Ish-bosheth was losing a war. Ish-bosheth, with Abner as his general, was losing a war against Yoav and David. What does he do? He picks up and he moves across to a different place, to a place called Yavesh Gilad. But still, it's across the Jordan River. Generally speaking, when people leave Israel, I don't want to say that the idea that you mentioned that he's expanding the kingdom is wrong. It's an interesting idea. But I have to say, once you cross the Jordan River and you're sort of out of Israel proper, really, you may be on the run. And here's why I want to show you another pasuk. Take a look, if you will. Flip the page to pasuk Yud, to Perek Yud Dalet. Perek Yud Dalet.
Perek Yud Dalet.
Perek Yud Dalet. Verse 30. This is a section where we get back to the southern kings. This is Rehoboam. Yeravam gets three chapters, by the way, and Rehoboam gets nothing. He gets from chapter 14:25 to 31. He gets all of six psukim. Again, that's not an insult against him. He gets much more time. He gets a lot more press time in Divrei Yamim. It's just because that doesn't interest the northern prophets that are writing this. This may have even been inserted later by Yirmiyahu.
Okay.
So what does it say? Well, let's start with verse 29. This is the sum up of Rehoboam's rather miserable life. They're written in the Chronicles of the Book of Judah. That's not our Chronicles, that's a Chronicles of the King. ומלחמה הייתה בין רחבם ובין ירבם כל הימים. What does that say? All of his life, every last day. How long did he rule for, by the way? Take a look at Pasuk. He ruled for 21 years. Where is that? I lost.
No, he ruled for 41. It's in Pasuk 21.
No, he's 41 years old.
You are right.
He was 41 years old.
17.
Oh, Shvat Shana. Look at verse 21. I'm sorry, he has a little more press time. His press time starts in verse 21. Rechavim ben Shlomo Alach Bidad ben Arbeim Bachat Shana. He was 41 years old. Rechavim ben Malko, when he took over the throne. Ushvat Shana Malach Yushlaim. Which means there was a war, and it lasted exactly 17 years. But wait a second. I just thought the prophet said, did the prophet just say everybody should go home? So I think the answer is probably obvious to anybody who knows something about the history of Israel, you know, between 1967 and 73. I think it's quite clear, or between 56 and 67. So there's a war of attrition. I think that's what's going on. Again, this is where you have to read in order to read the Pesukim carefully. If you just read one Pesuk by itself, you get a very black and white and incorrect view of what's going on. If you read, as a whole, the book as a whole, so you start to get a more shadowed approach where people are actually acting like human beings rather than, cut out characters that sometimes we make our, people of Tanakh. There was a war his whole life, and it makes sense that there's a war his whole life.
Where does it say anything about a war?
Verse 30. Umulchama hayita ben yerchavam ben kol hayamim, his entire life. He fought a war entire his life. What's that?
So in the time that the two nations existed, wasn't the relationship
always tense? Yeah, but I would say more, but the question is how do we, here, if we read 30 by itself, there's active war for 17 years. That's more than just tense. That's not a cold war. If we read back the prophecy of Shemaiah, there's no war whatsoever. Everybody says, oh, the prophet spoke, let's all go home now. Rabbi gave a pulpit speech, we're all going to listen right away. That doesn't, the Lord knows that doesn't happen. Right.
That's a pretty sizable group mass. And if it lasted for 17 years, then probably a lot of people did go home. And there was probably fighting, but it wasn't as...
Yes, I agree. I think that, and in my opinion, that's what the prophet was shooting for. I don't think the prophet really dreamed that everybody would back up and go home. I think he was trying to minimize damage on both sides. Now, we're not going to do a study of Dibrei Yamim here, but it's very interesting. Earthworks have created all kinds of interesting things happen in this non-war. It has a very, very East Berlin, West Berlin feel. It has a very, West versus East, which I think is probably not too far from the truth, but I just wanted to point out, I guess the point I'm really trying to make is, we read Tanakh, you have to read it, you have to take in a lot of Pesukim and try to read it in shades of gray, which is really the truth, rather than take a single Pesukim. So let's continue on. And how much time? We have 15 minutes, so that's just enough time for me to broach a hot subject. In Chaf Hei, I have to say, it's possible that Sarah is right, that essentially he's trying to extend the kingdom, but my tendency is to say that things got mighty hot in Shechem. Mighty hot, and it was time to bug out a little bit, and I don't want to say that they conquered Shechem, but sometimes, it's very dangerous to move your capital right, next to enemy lines. It's safer to move them a further away. What does Chafav say? Vayomer Yerovam b'libo, atah tashuv mamachar beit David. Ah, very good. That's correct. In fact, most people don't read Chafav connected with Chaf Hei. Let me explain to you how most people read Chafav. Chafav is connected with Chaf Zayin. So let's read those two psukim together, and I'll show you how most people understand this text. Vayomer Yerovam b'libo, it's a new story. Now the kingship is going to, go back to the house of David. Why? If the nation will do their pilgrimage to Jerusalem, the Shav Lev Ha'am Hazeh El Adonehem El Rechavam Melch Yudah, then they're going to say, oh, he's a good guy, he's not such a bad guy anyway. V'hara Guni, and they'll kill me. V'shavu Rechavam V'shavu El Rechavam Melch Yudah. There's a complex and slightly paranoid person here, do you see? Because there's one fact here which is totally insignificant if you're just worried about rulership, and that one fact is, that's not what you were talking. You were worried about losing your throne. That's fine. I believe it's another reinforcement. I believe it is reinforcement of what was driving Rechavam. And you have to wonder, Yerovam, and what were his motives? And I think they're partially realistic and partially paranoid.
Well, can you think of anybody who has rebelled from the time of Shaul who wasn't
killed?
Yeah.
No. Just a second.
Maybe you want to touch with the Ehud Shimi ben Gera, who cursed the king.
He was killed.
Yeah, that's true. No, he wasn't Shimi ben Gera. Oh, yeah, he was. But he was killed later, yeah, but he wasn't killed at the time. God would let him go. Although it's not always clear why. So what you're saying is that this is a practical, realistic evaluation of the situation. They are going to leave me, and by the way, as an incidental, when they leave me, they will kill me. The question is, if they would have left out the word, what he's about to do, I guess I'll foreshadow, what he's about to do is he's about to build a second Beit HaMikdash, so to speak. He's about to build two big bamot that people will worship to, rather than going back to Yerushalayim. But the question is, what was the motive? Is the motive because, I don't know, maybe you're right, maybe it's insignificant, maybe he's simply just stating the fact, maybe the motive is all of them. A, they'll leave me, B, if they leave me, I'm dead. I'm just trying to figure out whether he's a petty guy, or whether he's a politician. He's heard the prophecy, he's supposed to be, in some sense, he's heard the prophecy. He's heard that as long as he does the right thing, his kingship will be established. That's what Achiah Shiloni said back in verse, if we go back to chapter 10, was it chapter 10? I think so. I don't know. Might have been 11. Hold on a second. No, it's probably chapter 11. Yeah, chapter 11, verse 29. By Hebeite Yerabim Yatsa Yushlayim, by Yimsao Toch Yashilon Ish, then he finds him there, the prophet. But there, for whom the Chesed Salmai is wearing the cloak. He takes the cloak, he rips it into 12 pieces. By Yomer, verse 31, by Yomer the Yeravam, Kach Lecha Asar Krayim, you take 10 strips. He call Amar Hashem Lehi Yisrael, he need Korea, Mamacham Yad Shlomo, Venatati Lecha Et Asarah Shvatim. I'll give you the 10 tribes. Vashevet Echad Yelo, he gets the one extra tribe, that's Binyana. Maman Avdi David, Maman, etc., etc. Then he gives an explanation for that in verse 34. Verse 33, verse 34. And then he says, verse 35, I'll take away the kingship from his, the whole kingship from his son. I'm giving it to you. And then he says, verse 37, you rule whatever you want. If you do whatever I tell you, you walk in my path. I'll be with you. I'll give you a real, dynasty. Now, we spoke about how it might be a limited dynasty or whatever it was, but the bottom line is, why is he worried? I just don't get a feeling that he's listening to the prophet at any point. The prophet tells him to be the king. He doesn't really want to be. Once he gets to the king, the prophet's telling him this is how you should behave. And he just doesn't, he's not paying attention. And I think that's an important idea with Yerovam. Anyway, getting back to the issue, it looks like that what's prompting him to say that people will go back to the kingship is because people are going to Shalayim. But I don't think that's by itself. The real problem is also based on 25. Because he's now on the other side of the Jordan River, well, he's in Shechem, so he can put up a convincing show. But once he moves to the Jordan River, it weakens his presence in Israel. If you combine that with the fact that people are still making a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, now you have, perhaps, a very serious concern that he'll lose control. So let's continue on and see what he does. Vayivatz amelech vayashnei aglei zahav. Strange word. That first word should actually remind us of something. He takes advice. What's that? Sorry, verse 28 in chapter 12. I'm sorry, I know I'm bouncing a lot today. Vayivatz amelech, the melech takes advice. This is Yerovam. Oh, that's a good question. Hold on a second. Vayash shnei eglei zahav, he makes two golden calves. Vayom aleim rav vachem me'alot Yerushalayim, he says to his people, I assume his people, don't go back to Yerushalayim. The word rav vachem I'm going to work with in a second. Hine Elohecha Yisrael, hear your gods are Shealucha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Yeah, why does that make you laugh? It's the same words as who said?
The people.
I was out. What? Why you say Lahav? Oh, because they were trying to get. To, yeah, why you say Lahav?
Because these are the gods that took you out of Egypt.
And I'm saying at Har Sinai, or you know, when, at the Eagle of Zohar,
yeah.
It was because Moshe had taken them out of Egypt, and he wasn't coming back.
Yeah.
And that's when they had the Eagle of Zohar.
Yeah, but what you say is, what do these words have to do? These words are completely non sequitur.
You say the word Eagle, it's a keyword, you know.
Yeah.
To trigger something.
Right.
So you're thinking if he's going to set up an Eagle, you got to juxtapose that to the other event where there was.
I thought the other event that would be like juxtaposing. I would be like saying, you know what, let's throw a party just like the St. Louis, like the St. Valentine's Massacre of 1929. That's weird, isn't it? Because we all know, we're all born and bred on the idea that everybody thought that the Eagle was the worst idea since sliced toast. But not only is he building Eagles, he's re-quoting complete non sequitur to read. That is, there's no reason for him to say Asher Elokim Eretz Yisrael. There's no purpose of that whatsoever, except the fact, don't forget where he just came from. He just came out of exile in Mitzrayim. He may see himself, to be honest. But nonetheless, he's talking to his people, and he quotes he's quoting Aaron specifically. He's not just saying, let's build an Eagle because it looks nice, because it beats, I don't know, a golden Toyota. He is specifically trying to recreate an event in Har Sinai that we all thought was the worst thing since sliced toast. And before you think it's just an accident, I would like to introduce you to something that was in my note, but some of you may not have gotten to it. What I'd like you to do, just to jump ahead a little bit, is take... What? Oh, I know, I sent it out today, so if you get batched, I usually send it out the day before, so the email shows up on Tuesdays. I sent it Tuesday morning, so some people get it right away, but most people get it in batch, so you'll see it tomorrow, if you see it. But so you know why? That's good. I have a surprise for you then. Let's take a look at the two sons' names. Yerubim has two sons. Let's see what their names are, shall we?
Where is this?
And let's scan on a little bit. He has one son who gets sick and dies. Really? In Pasuk Chavtet? Yeah, by Yisan Avi and Divlat Yisrael and Yisrael Chamor. Where are we? In verse 12, Chavtet? No, those are the names of the cities. All right, we have sons, not here, but a little further on. I want to show you what his sons' names are. Just a second. You have to skip chapter 13. Good, look at, first of all, that's one son's name. Let's see what his name is. By Itahi, Chala, the first son of, chapter 14, verse 1. We'll meet son number 1 in chapter 14, verse number 1. And his name is... He never gets to be the king because he dies in this whole story. He goes to Achi Ashiloni, and Achi Ashiloni doesn't want to talk to him anymore because he's a big thug, because Yerubim's a big thug. His wife goes up, she dresses up. It's a really cool story, which we'll get to. But now I just want to show you what his two sons' names are. Beitei Chala, his first son's name is Avia. Okay. It's a good name. Ring a bell, anybody?
No.
Not yet. Okay, let's see what his second son's name is. Please skip ahead to chapter... chapter 15, verse 25. This is too good, by the way. This is good stuff. Chapter 15, verse 25. If you'd see it, hold it in for a second. Oh, I was going to say hold it in a second, so it's a surprise. Everybody see that? Chapter 15, verse 25. His second son's name is Nadav, and his first name is Abiyah. It's not really Abiyah. It's really what? It's really Abihu. So he names his two sons Nadav and Avihu, which are the sons who were killed because of the inappropriate worship that they did, worship that wasn't acceptable to Moshe Rabbeinu. You follow what's going on?
He's more than coincidence.
Oh my goodness, happy. If this is coincidence, then I don't know, I'm a stuffed chicken. I don't know, I can't think of anything good, but I eat a stuffed chicken.
Why?
What's that?
Why in the world
name is so now we have to rethink something. He is intentionally trying to recreate a movement in Israel that was snuffed out by Moshe Rabbeinu, intentionally. Which means, according to Yerubim, he feels that, you know who was right in the Ego incident? It wasn't Moshe, and by the way, and who wiped out everybody else along with Moshe? Those Levim. Oh, and by the way, while we're doing that, guess who got rid of all the Levim and Kohanim in his territory? Let's open up to chapter 12, if you would humor me. Open up back now to chapter 12 after he sets up the Bamot. Let's see who he has working in the Bamot. Verse 31. Vayas beit habamod, vayas kohanim miktsot ha'am. He took them from the edges of the society. Asher lo hayom bnei Levi. And then we're going to find out that Levi and Cohen get out of town. Now the Radak spices it up a little. The Radak says they refuse to serve, and because they refuse to serve, then Yeravam told them to get out of town. But that's not what the Pasuk says. The Pasuk says that he didn't even go to Levi. And why would he go to Levi? Because Levi was backing the anti-Ego movement. You follow what's going on? According to Yeravam, the Ego was a good idea. What? No, Levim were all over.
Yeah.
Levim were scattered throughout. Yeah. We'll actually.
But they had Yerushalayim as their primary.
That's what he said.
They were arrayed with Levim throughout the country.
That's correct. That's right. And not only that, we see in the end of the Book of Shoftim, there's a guy named Michaihu and there's Levim on the move. And not only that, the Levi goes up to Dan. It's going to be connected. The Levi goes up to Dan and they're, you know, Levim, we're happy to be involved. You know, okay, you know what? Every Levi's the firmest Levi in the world. And the answer is, yeah, it's a pretty good, you know, we always say that this book is very king-oriented and Ezra is very Levi and Cohen-oriented, but this is a good compliment to Levim. But it's more significant. We tend to think of the Egel Zahav being snuffed out in an instant. Moshe comes down, throws it down, and everybody immediately goes, sorry, Moshe, we all made a big mistake. We all agree. It's not that simple. If it was that simple, Yeravam wouldn't make an Egel Zahav. Recollect Aaron's words, Elohecha Yisrael, Asher Alucha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, and name his sons, Nadav and Avihu. He's trying to recreate himself as an Aaron, as an Aaron. That redraws, in my mind, an entire picture about what's going on as far as the Egel Zahav. And I will mention something. There's a famous medrash. Everybody know how the Egel got instantaneous? It was, there's a medrash, and of course it's a homily. You can't take it, you shouldn't take it literally. Most people do. That why did they build the Egel? What was the mistake? You know, it's famous, but every kid knows it. What was the mistake? Can I ask your son? How come they gave up and they built the Egel? What was the mistake that they made? Do you remember the mistake that they made? Why did the Jews build the Egel? Why did they think Moshe wasn't coming down? Oh, I never heard that one. That's very interesting. Oh, I never heard that. I heard the thing. What's that? What's this? Where was the coffin?
In Shemaya.
So they showed them that Moshe was dead in the clouds, and therefore they gave up hope. Oh, it's very interesting. I never heard that message. I wonder what is the point of that? That's something to think about. I heard the other message that I grew up with was that Moshe told them 40 days and 40 nights. They waited 40 days. They didn't know it was a full 40 nights, so 12 hours, they managed to, you know, they gave up hope. So, first of all, in Shemot, Moshe never says going up to 40 days and 40 nights. And I'm sure the people despaired long before their leader, and they're sitting in the middle of the desert with enemies all around. I'm sure they despaired way before 40 days. But according to that medrash creates a conundrum that has to be solved by another medrash, which is how do they build an Egel in 12 hours?
Right.
While everybody's sleeping. So there's an instant, it's instant Egel. Does everybody remember how the instant Egel took place?
Yeah, Aaron throws it into the fire.
Throws what into the name of the fire?
All their jewelry, the gold.
Yeah, but there was something else. It was the Shem first, but it was another name also. The Shem of Shevet Yosef.
Mm-hmm.
Shem of Shevet Yosef. That's right. Yosef's symbol, his name Yosef, was thrown in. And out pops an Egel. And by the way, don't forget what the symbol of Yosef is.
Sure.
Yosef's symbol is an Egel. So I asked you, what? Yeah, the Choshar Hadalo, exactly right. And look on anyone, not that you can prove anything from the stuff that's on the walls in the shuls, but go and take a look and see what the symbol of, if you go to Hadassah in the Har Tzofim, you'll see Shigal's windows. He's always the shore, because he was the shore. That was always the symbol of Ephraim and also Menashe. Well, Menashe may have had a tent, but really Yosef was the Bechor Shor, Hadalo. So what do you think that medrash means? They threw in the name of Yosef, and out pops an Egel in the shape of Yosef's tribe. So I ask you a question.
Yeravam's
also from Shevet Yosef. What a coincidence.
Right.
What a coincidence. If you ask me, I would say I have a feeling I know who was behind the Egel incident in Mitzrayim, in the Bamidbar. Now, there's no proof of this, because no Shevatim are mentioned except Levi. Levi comes up, he starts killing a lot of people. But we don't have the sense that there's a tribal movement of the Egel Zahav. It seems everybody against Levi. But I don't think so. I think it was Shevet Ephraim was involved in it. And there's some subtle criticism against Shevet Ephraim. Remember, Shevet Ephraim left Mitzrayim early, and they saw the bones of the people of Shevet Ephraim who were killed. Sefer in Divrei Hayamim, there's also an indication that some people did make it to Israel and actually built a city while the people were in Mitzrayim. I'm not going to get into that now. But to think that Bnei Yisrael were a completely united people is not a good idea. It's just not a. It didn't happen then. It didn't happen. It didn't happen now. What's that? What's that? What's that?
It's not terribly believable either.
I don't think so, but we tend to look at that. You know, the 12, all the elements connect into a jigsaw puzzle. And when we look at the map of Israel, it's one big happy jigsaw puzzle. That's not the impression. And the other power player next to Shevet Yehuda was always Shevet Ephraim. Mm-hmm. Devorah was from Shevet Ephraim. Gidon was from Shevet Ephraim. Yiftach, even though he was a punk, was from Shevet Ephraim. Pardon me, Yiftach. The guy sacrifices his daughter, what could I say? They were all from Shevet Ephraim, not all from Shevet Ephraim, but most of the leaders in Shevet Shoftim were from Shevet Ephraim, or Shevet Menashe. Most of them, or half of them at least. Otniel ben Knaz was Yehuda, Yehoshua, Shevet Ephraim. So the other power player, you know, we tend to think that the Jews were walking meekly through the desert, nobody had any comments to make. But we see that there's a tribal movement. The tribal movement is Shevet Levi. So what was Ephraim doing? In my opinion, I have to say that Ephraim was probably behind, I don't want to say, they were all, I mean, that all Bnei Israel was accused for the Egel. There's no doubt about it. It was a global sin. But I have to say, if you ask me who the leaders were who were pushing it, in Baal Peor, I'm sorry, I've run over time, so I'll stop here. In Baal Peor, we know who the leaders were. Shimon. Right? We know it was Shimon, because 30,000 people of Shimon disappear. If you take a look at the numbers, there's 60,000 people in the first generation and 20,000 people in the second generation. Where did they go? Answer, they were killed by, not all by, what's his name with the spear, by Pinchas with the spear, but a great deal of them were killed, and Cosby, but what was his name? Zimri ben Falu, is that his name? Zimri ben Saloon, right. So it was a Shimon movement. I want to argue without any proof except for what I'm saying here that there was another movement, which was an Egel Zahav movement, which was not always looked at negatively. It was not, certainly Yeravam looked at the history not as a mistake, but as something that maybe should have taken place. Maybe there should have been an Egel. Maybe it would have been a better form of worship. And I'll just leave you off with a question right now. But doesn't that mean he's an Ovdei Avodah Zara? So the answer is, there are two types of Ovdei Avodah Zara. One is called worshipping idols, and the other one is called strange worship. So we'll take a look next time at Egel Zahav, and we'll see there's a big fight between the Rishonim about whether Egel Zahav is worshipping God in the wrong way, or whether it's worshiping other gods. It's a machlokah between Rashi and Ramban and Rashbam. It's an interesting subject, and I think we have to analyze it, because we need to know what's going on in Beit El. Is it Avodah Zara as in Avodat Elilim, or is it Avodah Zara as in Nadav and Avihu, who brought, why did they die? Because they brought Eish Zara. That's correct. So the word Zara has two possible meanings when it comes to Avodah Zara.
That's the case, then we'll could argue that the Christians do it about Avodah Zara.
Don't get me into trouble here. Oh, this not, they're not monotheistic, so I don't have a problem there.
Oh,
I'm going to erase that, by the way. Thank you for getting me into trouble.